Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lori Wallach of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who examines the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership International Free Trade Treaty and the threat posed to banking, environmental, and labor regulations by this secret trade deal. Mattia Kramer, Research Director with the National Priorities Project, who discusses the hardship caused by the upside-down priorities chosen by Congress during the recent government shutdown. And Britt Kochenour of Greenpeace, who talks about the international campaign to pressure the Russian government to release the 30-member crew of the group's ship Arctic Sunrise, held since the activists engaged in a direct-action protest in the Arctic Ocean. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
New documents disclosed by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden detail how the National Security Agency has been deeply involved in targeting for drone strikes in Pakistan and engaged in cyber attacks against Islamic militants. The leaked documents reveal how deeply the NSA and CIA were involved in covert operations leading to drone strikes and targeted killings of militants in the northwest tribal areas of Pakistan. Under the Obama administration, there have been hundreds of drone strikes against militants in Pakistan, which have extended to Yemen and nations in Africa. According to independent surveys, U.S. drone strikes have killed an estimated 3,000 people, including hundreds of civilians, leading to intense civil unrest inside Pakistan. The covert drone program, publicly represented as a CIA-run operation, relied heavily on the NSA's ability to sift through vast numbers of emails, phone calls, and other communication data. Driven by the surging price of gold and a new free trade agreement, Canadian mining magnate Tom Schrake flew to northern El Salvador to stake his gold claim. Pacific Rim, Schrake's mining company, drilled extensively across a 34-square-mile exploration zone in the province of Cabañas, but the permit to open a large-scale gold mine was shelved due to growing opposition to gold mining in El Salvador. After El Salvador denied Pacific Rim's application to expand its El Dorado mining operation in Cabañas, the company filed a complaint against the Central American nation with a little-known International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes, run by the World Bank. The body initially rejected Pacific Rim's claim, declaring it didn't have jurisdiction under the Central American Free Trade Agreement, but the company is now pursuing the case under Salvadoran law. A final ruling is expected in mid-2014. According to the Christian Science Monitor, mining opponents, which include eco-activists, community groups, and the Catholic Church, pressured El Salvador to place a temporary halt on gold mining in 2008. Among the many issues raised against gold mining was the dangerous byproducts of water contamination and shortages of fresh water for agriculture in rural communities. In 2011, a Salvadoran government strategic study concluded that mining could be feasible if appropriate regulations and safeguards were put in place. Meanwhile, Pacific Rim has filed a claim for more than $300 million in damages against El Salvador for lost profits. Wages at fast food restaurants like McDonald's are so low, workers received over $7 billion in public assistance benefits through Medicaid, CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and food stamps. In recent months, impoverished fast food workers have marched for higher pay, with many demanding a wage increase to $15 an hour, benefits, and the right to form unions. Currently, part-time fast food workers earn a median wage of $8.65 an hour with no health benefits, according to the University of California, Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education. In a separate report, the National Employment Law Project disclosed that the 10 leading fast food chains, including McDonald's, Burger King, Subway, and Dunkin' Donuts, made nearly $7.5 billion in profits in 2012. While McDonald's CEO Donald Thompson made $13.7 million in executive compensation last year, his workers received $1.2 billion in taxpayer-funded benefits, mostly in Medicaid and other government-run healthcare programs. After the Great Recession, low-wage jobs have grown as a total share of the U.S. workforce. As a result, 44% of the nation's fast food workers are eligible for public assistance programs. Even if most fast food employees worked full-time, half of them would remain mired in poverty. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The Obama administration is now gearing up to enlist support for its effort to pass the newest free trade treaty, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, through Congress by the end of the year. The TPP, as it's known, is a proposed trade agreement between the U.S., Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam that would set new rules on trade and non-trade issues such as food safety, internet freedom, the cost of pharmaceutical drugs, financial regulation, and environmental protection. Signatories to the trade agreement would be forced to change their nation's existing domestic laws and regulations to conform to the new rules adopted under a future TPP treaty. What's alarmed many social justice, civil liberties, environmental, and labor rights advocates is the tight circle of secrecy that surrounded the ongoing negotiations on the trade treaty. While members of Congress have had either no or very limited access to read the proposed text of the TPP or the right to observe negotiations, 600 or more trade advisors, largely representing the interests of large corporations, have had easy access to the proposed treaty text and are invited to attend negotiating sessions. President Obama has called for the rarely used fast-track authority that would give him the right to sign the TPP agreement before Congress votes on it. And when Congress does vote, it will be under restrictive rules, limiting debate, and prohibiting all amendments. Your reporter spoke with Lori Wallach, director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who examines the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty and the threat she believes is posed to food safety, banking, environmental, and labor regulations by this secret trade deal.
Well, it's really a trade agreement in name only. It's huge. It includes 12 countries. It's by far the most impactful agreement since NAFTA and the World Trade Organization. And of its 29 chapters, only 5 actually have to do with trade. The other 24 chapters create all sorts of new rights and privileges for corporations or set constraints on what our government is allowed to do to make sure the food we feed our families is safe, or that we are able to stop fracking and other environmentally dangerous activities, or that, for instance, medicine is affordable. The chapters that don't have to do with trade include a lot of the policies that have been rejected in Congress. So just for instance, folks might remember SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act. That law really was about undermining our internet freedom, making it such that we would face big fines for things we do every day on the internet. There is half of that law, which the public basically forced Congress to say no to last year, is stuffed into the copyright chapter of TPP. Another chapter would ban Buy American preferences in government procurement. Those are the policies that say when the government buys stuff using our tax dollars, they need to buy American stuff so that they sow the money back into our communities and create American jobs. Another provision, one that Connecticut Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro has helped bring to everyone's attention, would undermine our food safety. Would require us to import food that doesn't meet our safety standards. So you wouldn't know what you're feeding your kids actually is safe. Those are all in the so-called trade agreement. Plus, it has the privileges for offshoring that make offshoring less costly and less risky that were in NAFTA, only much expanded. And TPP includes Vietnam, which is a lower-wage offshoring alternative to even, say, China. So I guess the shorthand would be NAFTA on steroids with Vietnam.
You know, the secrecy of this thing is pretty sinister. And I wonder if you'd focus a little bit of attention. What has been the Obama administration's strategy on keeping so much secrecy surrounding this Trans-Pacific Partnership free trade negotiations, given that even his predecessor, as you wrote in an op-ed piece recently, that even George W. Bush was more transparent about free trade agreements that he was negotiating during his presidency?
Well, I think that actually the best answer is what the previous top U.S. trade official, the United States Trade Representative, Ambassador Ron Kirk, said last year when a reporter asked him, wait a minute, you're trying to sign this agreement this year, and not even Congress has been able to see what is a rewrite of a wide swath of American law. The public's in the dark, the press is in the dark. Why? And Ambassador Kirk said, well, the last time an agreement was made public, that was what George W. Bush did, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, the last time one of these big NAFTA expansions was made public, you know, once the public saw it, we could never sign it. Well, as Senator Elizabeth Warren said shortly thereafter, hello, if it's too damaging to sign when the public knows what it is, that means we shouldn't sign it.
Lori, what's the timeline here on schedule for ratifying this trade agreement? And is it just the Senate or the House, too, that has to vote on this?
You would think this would be a treaty, and it would require a supermajority, two-thirds of the Senate, but it doesn't. It will be passed by a simple majority of the House and the Senate, and the first piece of business is to try and finish the deal. Now, as the word has gotten out about what the heck is in there, in other countries there's growing opposition. So far they haven't been able to sign the deal. They haven't been able to get all the countries to sign up to these outrageous corporate goodies. And the goal now is a big push to get it signed by the end of this year. There was a summit that was held a few weeks ago of the heads of state of the TPP countries. President Obama couldn't go because of the government shutdown. That was where arms were going to be twisted and the final deal hammered out. Now the new deadline is the end of the year. And to some degree, and this gets to the secrecy, it's on all of us to make sure that doesn't happen. And here's how we do it. The Dracula strategy. The TPP is like Dracula. It can only live in the dark. So our job is to drag it into the sunshine. How to do that? There are a lot of great action ideas and good information at ExposeTheTPP.org. That's www.ExposeTheTPP.org. All of us need to ask our members of Congress, and the House is where the fight's going to be on this one. It's not going to be the Senate. The House goes first. So we need to ask our members of the House for copies of the text. Why do we ask them for this, even though it's not available? Because it highlights how outrageous it is. By asking them and them having to say no to you, you highlight how outrageous it is that this agreement's about to be signed, and they haven't seen it, and either of you. The second thing everyone can do to make sure this dreadful deal does not become reality is to get commitments from your members of the House of Representatives to not give away their constitutional authority through fast track. If there's a normal debate and this agreement gets looked at carefully, it won't get passed as is.
That was Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Learn more about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Treaty by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Tea Party-led shutdown of the federal government ended after 16 days when the Senate and House agreed on temporary measures to reopen the government and pay the country's debts. But as Americans try to pick up the pieces, the nation faces another set of congressional deadlines and the possibility of another government shutdown on January 15th and a new debt ceiling cliffhanger on February 7th. The shutdown focused attention on what Congress considers essential versus non-essential government services, as employees at the Pentagon kept working while the distribution of infant formula to poor mothers for their babies was put on hold. Elsewhere, some Head Start programs were shuttered, a National Institute of Health clinical center that treats hundreds of patients for cancer was closed, and national parks and monuments were shut down, which triggered a loss of income for thousands of nearby small businesses. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mattia Kramer, research director with the National Priorities Project, who discusses the hardship caused by the priorities chosen during the government shutdown, how the American people can effectively make their voices heard to prevent another similar shutdown in 3 months, and the possibility of benefit cuts to social safety net programs like Social Security and Medicare in the coming congressional White House budget negotiations.
The official guidance during the shutdown was that essential programs were those that, quote, protected life and property. And that was a term that was basically used to include all typically considered national security programs. So certainly the Department of Defense maintained its various military programs during the shutdown. It temporarily had civilian furloughs, but those were reversed almost immediately. So the hundreds of thousands of employees at the Department of Defense essentially proceeded apace during the shutdown, and that included some stealth operations overseas to attack terrorist targets in Somalia and some other places. So we saw the definition of national security being considered deeply essential during the shutdown and not being affected, therefore, by the shutdown. Whereas domestic programs, and whether that was nutrition assistance for children, whether it was funding for domestic violence shelters, whether it was funding for the early childhood education program Head Start, or even cancer care for children at the National Institutes of Health, all of those things were considered non-essential during the shutdown. Apparently, our lawmakers did not consider them to protect life and property. And of course, not only could you argue with that, but I think it's deeply troubling for many people who hear that.
During the shutdown, you know, there were some demonstrations by federal employees who wanted to go back to work, but it seems there wasn't much other opposition in the street. What can regular Americans do to make sure we don't have a repeat of this in a couple of months?
There was not the kind of wide-scale protest that I think many of our peer nations would have seen in a similar situation. It takes a lot to get Americans protesting in the streets. It does. As we look ahead to these next deadlines, what we as a people can do to prevent another kind of calamity like the one we just came through, we are absolutely powerful. And this is a message that I think people sometimes find hard to believe, but it's true. Our lawmakers, our elected officials in Congress pay attention to the calls that they get from constituents. That 20 people from a congressional district, 20 angry people making calls to their elected official can scare the heck out of that representative or senator, because in that office in Washington, they do a calculation and they know when they hear from a handful of angry people that there are a lot more out there. So if we actually organized ourselves, or even in a disorganized fashion, if we were simply angry enough as a people to call en masse, overwhelmingly, our elected officials and say, we will not stand for this anymore. If you continue to run our government this way, we will boot you out of office. Boy, we would see a change.
Mattia Kramer, this is speculation, but people were so mad, especially at the Tea Party members of Congress who held the government hostage in an effort to stop Obamacare, that I wonder if this could have an impact on the 2014 elections, although no doubt it would have a bigger impact, you know, if the elections were next month.
Yes, I think it could have some impact. I also think you're right that voters do have relatively short memories. It will depend on how the campaigns are run. You know, if voters are reminded that, for instance, it was their elected official who supported the strategy to shut down the government because of Obamacare, I think that that could effectively jog voters' memories. But it won't have the same impact that it would, certainly, if elections were next month as opposed to next year. And of course, you know, the truth is that if elections were next month, we never would have seen that strategy roll out because elected officials would have been too afraid of retribution at the polls.
There have already been tremendous budget cuts, and in the next few months, it looks like President Obama is likely to bargain over cuts to Medicare and Social Security. What impact do you think the shutdown and most Americans' response to it will have to these proposed additional cuts?
I'm not sure that the shutdown that we've just come through will impact the discussion about Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. So those programs are being talked about under the term entitlement reform, and you know, people agree or disagree on whether or not that's an appropriate term. I'm not sure that the shutdown will guide Americans in their thinking about that issue. It is the case that President Obama has signaled some willingness to make changes to those programs in exchange for instance, tax reform, in which we raise taxes on some of the wealthiest Americans. The Republicans are certainly interested in this idea of entitlement reform and rolling back benefits in those programs in order to reduce long-term federal spending. They are not, however, interested in raising tax rates on the top earning Americans. And so whether there ever could be a deal struck anyhow is unclear. But you're right to say that it is being talked about in a way that perhaps seems more likely than it ever was under George W. Bush.
That was Mattia Kramer, research director with the National Priorities Project. For more analysis on federal budget priorities and the impact of the recent government shutdown, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. We'll be right back. On September 18th, members of the environmental activist group Greenpeace boarded and attempted to scale a Russian-owned Gazprom oil drilling rig in the Arctic Ocean. The Russian military responded to the nonviolent direct action protest, designed to draw attention to the environmental hazards of drilling for fossil fuels in the Arctic, by firing guns and brandishing knives. All 28 crew members of the Greenpeace ship Arctic Sunrise and two freelance journalists that accompanied them were arrested by the Russian government. The activists and their ship were taken to the northern Russian city of Murmansk. Held in a Russian jail without bail, the Greenpeace crew have been charged with piracy, an offense that carries a 15-year sentence, and are now awaiting court proceedings to adjudicate their case. Greenpeace and its allies around the world have organized protests in 36 nations to pressure the Russian government to release the Arctic 30. 11 Nobel Peace Prize recipients have also formally called on the Russians to set the Greenpeace crew free. The Netherlands, where the Greenpeace ship Arctic Sunrise is registered, has filed a lawsuit against Russia at the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea in Hamburg, Germany, seeking the release of the ship and its passengers. The imprisoned activists are from 18 different countries. The ship's captain, Peter Wilcox, the only American citizen on board and a Greenpeace veteran, was captain of the Greenpeace ship Rainbow Warrior when it was bombed by French intelligence agents in 1985, which killed one crew member. Your reporter spoke with Britt Kochenour, Greenpeace public outreach director, who discusses the ongoing campaign to free the Arctic 30 and the environmental concerns that motivated the activists to engage in the nonviolent protest on the Russian oil rig.
It's a very serious situation, and we are certainly very concerned for the activists and the videographer and photographer, as you mentioned, and they are being held. All that have been through the bail proceedings have been denied bail so far. And the piracy charges, which are very serious, which should hold a possible sentence of 15 years in prison, although obviously we dispute those. Even President Putin himself had said they were obviously wrong. So we know that it's been a pretty tough time for all of the Arctic 30 there in prison. We know they've gotten their medical supplies. They've all had representation, but certainly the words that we're hearing and a few letters that have come through from them themselves, they're worried, and it's a very stressful time. And obviously, for those who are separated from their families and their loved ones, it's a pretty difficult situation.
Tell our listeners a bit about the charges that they're facing. From what I understand, the piracy charges on their own could bring a 15-year prison sentence if they are convicted. But what other charges are they facing? And I'm sure people have also heard that the Russian authorities a week or more ago talked about finding illegal drugs on the ship, the Arctic Sunrise. Maybe you could shed some light on really what's happening on the legal front.
Sure. The piracy charges are obviously the most serious and the main focus here. We certainly believe that the drug allegations are just part of a smear campaign, really to distract people from the support that the Arctic 30 have gotten. We assume that the Russian authorities are referring to the medical supplies. Our ships are obliged to carry them under maritime law. That's the only thing that we can assume that they're referring to. And in terms of the legal case, actually, the latest update is that the government in the Netherlands, where the Arctic Sunrise is registered, has announced that they've launched legal action under the UN Convention Law of the Sea, calling the detentions unlawful. So that's certainly the latest update on the legal front. And they have gotten support from around the world. We've had a lot of protests and rallies and vigils in over 45 countries. There's been really just a massive support for the Arctic 30 and the very brave actions that they've taken.
Britt, tell us about the objective of the nonviolent civil disobedience action that the activists on the Arctic Sunrise undertook that resulted in their captivity now. What is the concern about the Arctic Ocean and exploiting fossil fuels there that maybe were inaccessible before because of the constant ice, but now with global warming, we do have nations now thinking about setting up oil wells as Russia has now.
Right. Well, it's really, as you know, the sort of worst irony here that the reasons that there are people interested, Gazprom in particular, the company that has this particular oil rig, are able to even think about this drilling is because of the melting, which of course drilling would only increase and further help melt that ice, which is already at a really perilous point. The trend is really clear in terms of the science. So it's really this as being the very first of the oil rig, the first commercial offshore oil rig in the Arctic, really is symbolic, obviously, in terms of when the drilling continues and when it starts and why this particular oil rig was so symbolic for the activists who were in the peaceful protest to scale that rig, roll out a banner, and let the world know and make sure, since it is in a pretty remote part of the world to most of us, to make sure that Gazprom and others knew we are paying attention, the world is paying attention. And as the executive director of Greenpeace International likes to say, what happens in the Arctic just simply does not stay in the Arctic. If we drill there, it will have catastrophic effects for the rest of the planet.
Britt, what's the concern at Greenpeace and maybe other organizations that engage in nonviolent civil disobedience in terms of the precedent that could be set here with Russia's response to this nonviolent action in the Arctic Ocean?
Well, that's a great question and certainly a great point. And I think that anyone who believes in peaceful activism and believes that peaceful protest has always been really an important part of a path on social change, from Rosa Parks to Gandhi to Martin Luther King, all of the different folks and places we've seen in the movements that have really changed the world because of it. If this detention of the activists and charges of the activists is allowed to stand, it really strikes, you know, a very serious blow to peaceful activism. And I think particularly at this time, it's so crucial when governments around the world, they have not responded to, I think, what we would really consider to be pretty dire scientific warnings about the consequences of climate change in the Arctic in particular. And so it's important for people to be able to use their voices to be able to stand up and use peaceful activism in a time when we haven't seen governments and certainly corporations respond that they need to in the face of this very clear and coming crisis.
That was Britt Kochenour, Greenpeace Public Outreach Director. For more commentary on the detention of the Greenpeace activists and concern over exploiting fossil fuels in the Arctic region, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.